This is Dylan FM, a Freak Music Club podcast. I'm Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
And the album of the year is Time Out of Mind. Woo! Bob Dylan.
Mark Howard was in the room, hands on the dials, for every second of the recording and production of Time Out of Mind. Working as a recording engineer for Daniel Lanois, Dylan called Mark out and thanked him when they won the Grammy for the Best Album in 1998.
Daniel Lanois, who helped produce this, and Mark Howard, can't forget that. We got a particular type of sound on this record, which you don't get every day.
And Daniel Lanois called Mark out as well.
Mark Howard, you get a piece of this. Thank you.
Mark has had an amazing career as a musician, producer, and engineer, working with artists such as Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, Tom Waits, Johnny Cash, Emmylou Harris, and of course, Bob Dylan, plus many more. I'll put a link to his All Music page in the show notes where you can peruse the hundreds of top artists that he's worked with. Mark first worked with Dylan as an engineer on Oh Mercy, and was working with Lanois in his Teatro studio in Oxnard, California, when Dylan came by, in a process that led to Time Out of Mind. You'll hear about that initial visit and the process in today's episode. Mark explains how the unique sound of Time Out of Mind was achieved, shares more about the tension between Dylan and Lanois, tells us about the versions and recordings we haven't heard, and how the album almost got set aside and never heard at all. It's a fascinating dive into first-party details on the making of this great album. Mark wrote a book about all of his studio experiences called Listen Up. You can find a link to the book in the show notes and on our website. He has a new book of photography coming out this November featuring photographs taken inside all of those amazing studios with all of those incredible musicians, including Bob Dylan. We'll hear a little bit about that book in this conversation. I'm joined in this discussion with Mark Howard by music industry veteran Randy Sawson. So you'll hear three voices during the interview. Now let's talk with Time Out of Mind engineer, Mark Howard.
We got a call and saying Bob's interested in having us mix a live show he did in Atlanta for the Olympics. And it was for like a Japanese release. And so he just wanted to have this thing mixed. And so he came in while we were mixing it. And I'd finished mixing it, and at the very end of that mix, he says, do you think you could make the harmonica sound electric? I said, yeah, no problem. So I took the harmonica sound off, and I ran it through a little Ibanez distortion pedal and then into a little guitar amp. And so I put it in there, and so the harp sounded really cool the way he wanted it. But right after the harp finished, his voice came out of that amp, and he loved it. He goes, that's great. I want to do that on all the tracks. And so this was the beginning of what was called the vocal amp. So, you know, I'd have the regular vocal on a channel, and then I'd have the vocal amp on a channel. And so as I was mixing it, he goes, well, what's the percentage of the vocal amp to the clean vocal amp? I said, well, it's about 60-40. He goes, make it 50-50. And so it was pretty messed up sounding, I'll tell you. It sounded really distorted and really messed up. So yeah, so that's how Time Out of Mind kind of started off by mixing this live Atlanta mix. It was the Olympics, and he played the House of Blues or something like that. And so so they sent it to me, and I mixed it. And so then Lanois and him started talking about songs and stuff like that. And Bob says, yeah. And so Dan said, you know, well, just come on over and let us hear some. So Bob would come over, drive up in his pickup truck all by himself, no bodyguard or anything. And You know, Oxnard is like a very, it's like a Mexican town. It's like you feel like you're in Mexico. There's the pawn shop. Everybody's Mexican there. And once we dug into it, he said he'd come up. And so he says, yeah, I have this one song. He'd go on the piano and he'd play this thing. And Dan goes, well, that's nice. But I need to hear a vocal. And Bob didn't say anything. And so the next day, as we're mixing the thing, he goes, I got another one. And so he goes over to the piano again and he plays another thing. And Dan says, that sounds beautiful, but, you know, I need to hear a lyric, you know, some kind of. And so still nothing. And so the next day we had brought in this friend of ours from New York, Tony Mangurian, who is like a hip hop drummer. And he had made some records with Luscious Jackson, this girl group. And Dan had produced, co-produced it with Tony. So Tony was hanging out. And so the next day Bob comes in, Tony's there. And so we were thought, you know, we maybe try some loop stuff because Bob said he was interested in making a record, but he likes this kid called Beck and he wants his record to sound like this kid Beck. So we brought in Tony because he's this hip hop guy and he can play hip hop drums and stuff like that. So Bob gets on the piano. And I've got everything mic'd in the studio. So if anywhere you go, I just pop it and record and you're recording it. And so Bob starts playing on the piano. I can't wait. I can't wait. You know, like it's this, it's the, that track, can't wait. And so Tony starts playing this hip hop beat against it. And it's amazing, you know, like this kind of like almost gospel thing with this hip hop vibe with him, you know, muttering these words out. And so I recorded it and he'd sang a verse and he'd sang a chorus. And so he left that day and I just took that and I cut that into an arrangement of a song, just using that part of it. And so it was incredible, you know, and, you know, it was like one of those moments where your hair goes up and, you know, I think, wow, that's the shit right there. And so that was the plan. We were going to make the record there. And then suddenly, you know, we get a call from Bob saying, you know, look, I can't make a record here. It's too close to home. And I want to go to Miami. I'm like, oh boy, Miami. So we started looking for places in Miami and we ended up going to Criteria. And, you know, at the Teatro, everything's set up. You get great sounds in there. The piano, it was a Steinway piano. Everything was so beautiful. And anything you just touched sounded incredible. We go to Miami. I pack up the same microphones, the same. I brought some Neve BCM10 consoles. So I'm using all the same stuff. But when we get to Miami, it's Criteria, and they got this big room. It's very spitty. It's like all plaster. It's used. They use it for videos and stuff like that. So all the walls got curves, and it sounds terrible in there. And I'm struggling to really get a good sound in there. And so as those sessions started, you know, Bob had a list of people he wanted to have in. And so he wanted all of these Nashville people. And Dan doesn't like Nashville people, strummers and all that stuff. So, you know, we got Bob Britt, we got Cindy Cash Dollar, we got like all of these like Nashville, you know, strummers. And so that turned into a bit of a nightmare because there's like suddenly there's 15 people in the room and it's like a mess and it just sounds like horrible. And every take we do, Bob changes the key, which means like if you're a musician and you got to change the key, it's like relearning the whole song. Bob can just change the key and just play the song. But for other people, it's very complicated to kind of get it, you know, so suddenly this one's in C, the next one's in D, you know, like they're completely different and there's a lot of different stuff. So everybody was hitting bum notes and it was just sounding the worst you ever thought it could sound. And so the band would come in and Lamar goes, it's sounding so junky. If you don't know the chord, don't play it, you know, like it's like flipping out on everybody. And so Jim Keltner was one of the drummers. It was Brian Blade there and Jim Keltner. And we I had both kits side by side. So I panned Keltner to one side of the speaker and Brian was on the other side. So it made this kind of mash of a drum set. Lamoureux was getting frustrated because it was just, it wasn't gelling. And then, you know, we were trying to, we had cut the song Can't Wait, but Bob wouldn't play piano because I think he felt intimidated because Augie was there and so was Jim Dickinson. So Jim ended up playing piano, but it wasn't the same feel and it didn't have the right thing. So Dan wasn't satisfied with it. And so we cut it. And so every day Dan would work the band up. And so Bob would walk in at 4. And so he walks in one day and Dan's got doing a version of Can't Wait. And he's like mimicking Bob. I can't wait, you know, like pretending he's Bob. And so Bob came in and thought, the fuck's this? It's like Dan goes, oh, I'm just trying to get back to that Oxnard version of Can't Wait, you know, like just, he goes, we got it. It's done. He says, Tony, this is Dylan talking to Tony, the bass player. He goes, Tony, have I ever played anything twice the same? And no, Bob, no. See, it's never going to be the same. So it was like, so Dan was kind of like a little bit, you know, had met his match in a way of that he can't kind of get into what he was trying to get into. So that kind of caused a bit of an issue between Bob and Dan where Dan wasn't allowed in the control room anymore. And Bob kind of exiled him from the recording room, whatever. So Dan would be working on other songs that we'd recorded in another studio, you know, mixing them and stuff like that. And so, but when the Can't Wait thing happened, Bob had grabbed an acoustic guitar and grabbed it from the neck. So it's like he's holding the neck, but the body is over here. And so it's like, and he's like taking it and he's like, you know, kind of like a, just swinging it at Dan's head. He's like right here and he's just holding it and swinging it like if he's going to smash it over his head.
The total time in Miami was about a month. Is that right?
Yeah. I did about a month in there. You know, when I first arrived, you know, I didn't like the studio. I didn't like the way it sounded. So I started looking into, we called the BGs to see if we could use their studio and they didn't want us in their studio. So I thought I was going to rent this Masonic temple and just bring the gear in there. We make it in this beautiful Masonic temple and we couldn't get that to work. And so we ended up staying there and like the great room at Criteria where Eric Clapton did Ocean Boulevard and the Allman Brothers and all those great records. Well, that room now is their tape vault. Like it's not the same studio. It's like they've got all this shit in there and that's the best sounding room they got and it's full of junk. And so we ended up having to work in that room and I had to make it work. And I had actually made a little apartment for Bob with kind of these gobos and put a lamp in there for him. And he had his vocal amp in there, you know, little tables and stuff. So he was kind of like in the back of the room and then Keltner and Brian Blade were in front of him facing him. And then everybody was all scattered around. That's kind of like how Bob would work where he wouldn't wear headphones in the room, but he would only listen to the vocal amp. So there was like, if he wanted to change a word or something, like we recorded that song Highlands and it's 17 minutes long. So for him to fix some words he wanted to change, you know, like this is in the day that I'm on a tape recorder and it's, you got to take numbers all the time. Like, you know, where here's the verse that starts at a minute 10, the second verse is, you know, to 150 or whatever. So I would take numbers as I would go down and then just write the very first word and last word of each line. Cause he was singing so fast. So I had to like kind of block it all in. So because he wouldn't wear headphones and he was just singing to the vocal amp. So it made it difficult for me to punch in words. So I had to recreate that sound. So I put two speakers in front of him that I played the track to, and he would sing to those speakers. But I had to take his vocal out of the mix in the control room. So I had to have another little mic in front of him so I could hear him sing. So when I punched him out, I had to listen to this little speaker in the control room. And then once I hear he stopped singing, I have to punch out and bring that other vocal back in. So it was like this complicated events of to like punch in, fader down, listen to this one, punch out, you know, it's like, it's it. And so he started having a little bit of fun with me, and he'd go to the 16th verse and drop me in for the third word. And so luckily I had taken numbers on where that verse was, and I zipped there two words before, bang, he punched it in and meaning it out. You know, so that was easy. Yeah, okay, go to the fourth verse. I just want to go in for the last word. And it's like he was, I swear to God, he was making it up, because it was so kind of like ridiculous, you know, like just pulling numbers out of a hat kind of thing. There was periods there where, you know, where we'd do three takes, and each take would either be in a different key, or it would be kind of like a version, a different type of version. We would name each version, these three versions. It would be like the Ragdoll version, and then there was the Pink Floyd version, and then there was like another version. And so we listened back to them, and some of them were great, and some of them, you know, were half great. And so I had to like edit like the Pink Floyd version onto the Ragdoll version, and made it a better intro on it, or something like that. An interesting way of working, you know, just kind of by doing these different takes, you know, and then listening back. And then once we listened back to the three takes, Bob would sit beside me at the console, and he'd say, which take do you think it is? And I'd say, well, I think it's take two. And we'd listen to all three, and he goes, how did you know it was take two? I said, well, that's my barometer. Just that one felt best to me. It wasn't the best played, but it was the one that had the most emotion behind the vocal, and that means more to me than anything. Because that's right. Yeah, that's the one I picked too. And this kept going. Every time we cut a track, he said, "Which one is it now?" And I go, "It's take three." He goes, "You're right." You know? So he had my trust. You know, it's like he believed in anything I said. But if Lanois would have came over and said, "I like that take too," Bob would say, okay, we're using take one. You know, like you wouldn't let him get anything in, you know. So it was bizarre. And then, you know, before Lanois kind of had to get out of the control room, he would be standing behind us, and he would come over and he'd say, yeah, I like that guitar part there. And Bob would say, whose guitar is that? And he goes, that's Dan's. He said, take it out. And so I take it out, and what's on that channel? Oh, that's your guitar. Push that up. And so I was like, and Dan would come over and try to make comments, and Bob would turn to me and go, you hear somebody talking? And I'm like, nope. It was just like, they're playing games with each other. And it was just like the bizarrest thing you ever saw. It was a strange thing to witness.
You know? Mark, when you talk about different versions, like, why would you name it Pink Floyd? What was it?
I named him. I named him because of it had a very kind of like dreamy kind of like pedal steel kind of intro on it, where the other ones were more ragged, and kind of that's where the Ragdoll came in. And so, yeah, so it's easier to name them instead of take one, take two. You put a name against them so that really sticks, you know, like. Sometimes it will alter your opinion because it's a rag doll. You know, you want it to be rough. And so, yeah, so that's how they got named.
I would love to ask, like, I know Dylan likes to use the Sony C37 mic. Can you talk about that?
His choice. Yeah, that was our choice that he sang into that mic. The Sony C37 tube mic is the only microphone that you can get right up on it, where like a U47 or any other tube mics, you get moisture on the capsule and it starts to pop and sizzle and stuff. But for whatever reason, that microphone, you can get right on it your lips are touching it and it doesn't pop and it doesn't, it's it, and it sounds beautiful. It's a great sounding mic.
It's what most rappers today use, that still use that mic. That is one of the most popular mics in hip hop, is the Sony C37. So I thought it was so interesting that Dylan used it. You guys saw, you know, talk about it.
Yeah. We've gotten
still really popular today.
Yeah. Dan had bought a pair of those mics from Massey Hall in Toronto, and they were just like audience mics that they had. And so we bought them not knowing what they, you know, what they would sound like, but we started using them on the vocals and they started sound. And that was our mic of choice. And we should have kept quiet about it because we were getting them for, you know, $250 and now they're $5,000 each.
I know. Yeah. So when you do that dual mic recording, so that means that there's sort of a clean recording. In other words, how much of that mix is done in real time? But I guess you said before, because of Dylan, you changed it. So you've got a pure clean recording and you've got one through the
vocal amp,
more processed vocal amp.
Yeah. So there's two vocal channels. And so, you know, as we're mixing, he's always asking, what's the percentage? Is it 50-50? And sometimes he wants 60-40 vocal amp. More dirty and stuff like that. And so I'm not sure if you, when you listen to Love Sick when it comes on, you know, it's kind of a dirtier sound, you know, like,
yeah. So,
yeah. So that's that Sony C37 going through that amp, the story.
Walking with you in my head.
Because it's a tube amp, it picks up everything else too, you know. So that's why there's a dirtiness to that record, that a lot of the sound is coming out of his vocal mic, because everybody's louder than him in the room. So it's this trashier sound. If you take his vocal out, it would sound really dry and not interesting. But once you put the vocal with the bleed in it, it made it exciting sounding. So you, if you punch in and that band is not there, then you get this like hollow spot. That's why those speakers were there, whereas feeding the music into them to create a live situation. So when I punch in, that band's still playing, so it masks it really, because it won't work any other way.
The thing that's so interesting about Time Out of Mind is kind of like the sound of it, you know, it's like what you hear and what you don't hear. And the atmosphere. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about like how you guys created that and what the, without giving away any trade secrets, just kind of like what, you know, what is the process of kind of like the way you create the, you know, that atmosphere that almost like you can't hear it, but you feel it kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what I was kind of talking about with the leakage from the vocal mic. You know, there's, you know, like I said, there was like 15 or so people playing all in the room. Not all those things made the mixes. And I would just strip the stuff out and just, we would just use what worked best for the song. And so, you know, some of Augie's parts all made it. But, you know, like Cindy Cashdollar and Rubelad and who was the other guy? But yeah, so they got ducked out. And so I would just use like, that sounds good with the pedal steel, but you would be hearing them slightly ghosting through his vocal mic. So there's like this texture of stuff going on that is just, and then, you know, and I put like a delay on it. And so you get this, them with this delay and maybe a reverb or whatever. But it's, so that's how those sounds are created. Like if you took his vocal mic out, that's gone. But when you bring it back in, that's part of it. And then by using the effects on his voice and like on that song, Lovesick, you know, I put a flanger on for the playback. I just wanted to excite them when they came into the room. And so I played the song back and I had a flanger on his voice and this kind of like delay and it sounded really cool. And so I always print my mixes when they come in, because I perform to the band when they come in to hype them on certain things. I make certain things louder and, you know, bring his ride, his vocal and stuff like that. So I'd always print those mixes. And so that song Lovesick is a as soon as we had recorded it, that's the playback mix, and that's the one that you hear on the record. Wow. I could never better it. So that's what we used.
You did that in the room when you guys were doing, when you guys were working.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow. It was mixed on the spot. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
That is crazy.
And so when these versions are happening and 12 people are trying to play, how much time is elapsing working on one song? Is this going on for a day, for multiple days? Do things come back a week later?
It's maybe two or three songs a day. And so we work them up and we put them down and I do my little mixes and then we move on to the next song. And so we were working on analog tape, but I was using these like really big reels that, you know, you use them for like recording live shows and stuff like that. But they're on 14-inch reels and they're really large. And so if you run it at a slower speed, you can get 17 minutes on a reel, which is, you know, usually you don't get that much because it's a 10-inch reel. So you only get, you know, certain amount of time. And I can't remember what it is now. But yeah, you can only fit three takes maybe on a reel before you've used up all the tape. But with these big reels, you can do multiples. And that's how that song Highlands, it ends. And as soon as it ends, it rolls off. Like it ended right when the tape ended.
But I'm already there in my mind. Hey, that's good enough for now.
And that was a phenomenon. That was kind of crazy. Yeah, I have to put the reel it back on and then we'd have to listen again. Just to hear the very last one, it's got to roll off.
Yeah. How many songs have both drummers?
I'd say it's maybe 80%. And I think, what was the one? Kemper, right? It's the other. He came in and he blew it.
David really, Kemper,
David Kemper came in and he's like, well, I got to leave for the weekend. I got an art show in LA. And so he gets on a plane and flies back on the weekend and he doesn't return. Bob says, let's get Keltner in here. And Dan says, I want to get Brian Blade in here. And so, you know, it was like this whole thing. And then what about Jim Dickinson? And I said, well, I just finished a record with him. We can get him in. And so it was like, it took a scene change. And so people were starting to drift in. And, you know, Bob wanted like, you know, the Nashville strummers and stuff like that. And so, it came in and it got kind of messy, like I said, but,
I wanted to ask you one question about like Bob's, like, so when he records vocals, he never goes back in the booth by himself and plays to a track. He's always recording them live with the band.
Yeah. Right. With the band. Wow. And so he doesn't, you know, like, can you imagine Highlands at 17 minutes long? All those words are in his head. So he's got to come to me to look in my book to see what verses are where. And so he was constantly, we were looking over my notes that I was taking all the time. And wow. So none of this is written down on paper or anything. It comes right out of his head. And, you know, and sometimes different takes have different lines and different things that he's trying out, you know, because his whole thing is he writes the songs on a typewriter. He doesn't know what key the song sounds best in for his voice for this one. And so there's a lot of kind of like playing around, seeing which sounds good, you know, whether, oh, this works on piano, but it's better on guitar. And then
and how many songs did it make the record?
I would say, well, there's a lot of other versions. Like there's a whole other version of Highlands. It's just equally as good, but it's completely different lyrics. And so, this one won the playback. And so that's the one that we just used. And so, but there's another one that's another version of that that's completely different that's out there. And like I said, you know, there's a couple of different versions of Can't Wait. And so there's a lot of things. I guess was it Girl from Red River Shore? That wasn't on the record, right? Was that
right? That didn't come out until Telltale Signs. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so I think there was maybe three or four on the Telltale Signs, and then
March into the City.
Right. And, yeah, but that was a different name.
Dreaming of You.
Dreaming of You, and then
I have two other names that have floated around that no one's ever heard. Maybe you can confirm or add any color. So one is All I Ever Loved Is You.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Which became Doing All Right. No, there's one called Doing All Right, which the name switched to something else.
Yeah, Doing It Right. Doing It Right became
Till I Fell in Love with You.
Till I Fell in Love with You, yeah. But so there is something called All I Ever Loved Is You, or do you think that's maybe referring to the same song?
I think that might be referring to the same track.
And what about something called No Turning Back? Does that ring a bell?
That doesn't sound familiar at all to me. No, it doesn't ring a bell.
Time Out of Mind won the Grammys. There was a lot of accolades and recognition. It's to some degree, it was a turning point in Dylan's career. How do you think about it, at a 25-year anniversary and after all the way people still, I'm sure, to you respond to it?
It's a lot of people's favorite record. It's like I said, I was slightly embarrassed about it because I didn't think it was my best work. I didn't think I had the best sounds, but I created something with what I had. And that's why it sounded that way, because, the way it sounded in that room. And I was kind of like embarrassed that it didn't sound more hi-fi. Like I slightly prefer the sound of Oh Mercy. I like it's a little more in your face, it's drier. And where this one is, it's you can't get away from it because it's all on the vocal mic. Take that vocal mic out and the sound goes away. So it's definitely all the kind of built around that C-37A.
So the people who wish for the clean version, you're saying it wouldn't work because it's the magic is in that mic.
Yeah, the leakage of everybody playing in the room going into that mic. Yeah, I was kind of embarrassed because it wasn't sounding so great, and I was struggling to make it sound cool. And once I got back to Oxnard and was listening to it, because Dan didn't want to, like at the end of Miami, Dan didn't even want to hear. I said, here's a cassette, he didn't even want it. And so Bob took a cassette. And so it's weird because Time Out of Mind almost didn't come out because it after Miami, it shut down because it was such a mess. And
for
so
how long?
Months, it was a couple of months that was, it just went quiet. Everything went quiet, nothing. And then, I would be at the Teatro and I'd get a phone call. It'd be Bob, and Bob would go, "Hey, Mark, I've been listening." And he goes, "What do you think?" I said, "I think we got a great record. You should come back in. We'll finish it." And he goes, "Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see." And so that was that. And another time, I'm at home. It's like 3 a.m. and the phone rings and it's Bob. And says, "Hey, Mark, I wanted to talk to you. I've been playing the cassette that you gave me, at my friend's house in Santa Monica. And we were listening and his neighbor from downstairs came up and knocked on the door and said, what do you guys listen to? I got to have that." And so my friend told him that, it's his friend's record and it's not even available. It's not even done or whatever. And so this guy, by saying that, gave him the courage to come back in. So he eventually did come back in and we did sift through a bunch of stuff and made it, we finished it at the Teatro.
And what did you do there? Like, what do you mean by finish it? Like, did you put all the vocals on, the rest of the vocals?
It was mostly mixing. And so we put the track up, we'd listen to everything and we'd kind of make decisions. Let's get rid of, Cindy Cash, Dollar's Parts, mumbling around. And so, that's why there's not a lot of the stuff in. And that's probably why that record sounds that way, because it's really not a lot of stuff in there, but it's just enough to kind of make a vibe from it,
So when they pulled these tapes back up for Telltale Signs, I think they just picked other versions. I don't know if things were remixed. Were you involved in that, either in discussion or?
No, No, I don't think they were remixed. I think they were like these mixes that I had done. So they sound real authentic to that, that they haven't had anybody else put the tapes up or anything.
How do you feel about the idea of a, you know, you've seen what they've done in bootleg series reissues of some of the other albums where they dramatically expand them and put some more of those alt versions out. It seems like Time Out of Mind would be a great candidate. There sounds like there's a lot there.
I think there's a lot there to work with, you know, and just on for each song, there's multiple versions, and just to hear the four, I guess it's four different versions of Can't Wait. And even to just hear that original one, like the demo of that, I wish I had a copy of that because it just sounded so amazing. And so, I didn't have any control of, I didn't walk away with any tapes. So.
How does he achieve it live? Meaning you guys, you know, had this special equipment and the processing and the work you've done, you've obviously heard him, you know, those songs became staples for a long time now. How do they get that sound when they do it live?
Well, when they toured Time Out of Mind, I set him up with a little rig where it was the same pedal and the same little kind of like amp that he would hear himself through. So he would take it on the road, and that's like I mixed the Grammys show, and so for the Grammy show I had the vocal amp. And but it's a union gig, you know, the Grammys, and I'm not allowed to touch the console. I can only make suggestions. So I got to stand behind the engineer saying, okay, this is the vocal amp. We got to make sure that we got a lot of it in the mix. And so he's doing it. It's like they're just safe people there. And they just don't want to take any chances, I guess it is, you know, because they're so sterile. So I got him to get this vocal sound. So, and put the flanger. I brought the box that I got the flanger from, and plugged it in. So, we got that sound on him live. It's for that Grammy show. And do you remember that guy that jumped out?
Soy bomb.
Yeah. And so I'm like, that guy's not part of the show. Get him off the stage. And so I guess they finally got him up. But if you ever watched Bob's, you know, expression on his face, you know, it was like, what the fuck's going on? Who is this guy? And but I think that have you seen the footage that they've done? That they've remarkably removed him out of that.
The official version. He's gone, right?
He's gone. Yeah.
Dylan never used a producer again after Time Out of Mind. Does that surprise you?
No, because he saw what he could do without, you know. I think he was just at the point where, you know, he just wants to go in there and record, you know, without anybody's influence, I guess. And so he felt like that's how Time Out of Mind was made, that Lamwell was really just a kind of a side man, kind of, I guess, because, you know, like when Lamwell makes records for U2, he's kind of like a cheerleader, and he'll hype people and Bono, that's great. Yeah. And then that makes him sing better and this and that, but it doesn't work on Bob. So all of those tricks that he would work didn't work with Bob. So it was frustrating for him. And so he would come to me to say, what's Bob? And Bob, you know, would say, did Dan say that to you? I was like, no. You know, so it was a bizarre thing that I was being used as the middleman, almost, in a way, you know. It was uncomfortable, but, you know, rewarding for me.
But what did you think of those next few albums, Love and Theft and Modern Times? Some people think of those three together, just, you know, the period, right, and some of the sound.
Yeah, they have a similar, I think, songwriting is similar in a way of the way he's phrasing and using a lot of the same phrasing in a way. But I think still Time Out of Mind still has more of a upfront personal sound on his voice. Or those records didn't. They sounded, you know, very linear in a way compared to that, to me.
So one last thing, it occurs to me, you through yeah. the Mercy period and the Time Out of Mind period, you know, you spent a lot of time with Bob in the studio, motorcycle yeah. riding, everything else. You know, he's a guy people want to know a little more about. What can you tell us from your experience that we should know about Bob that we don't hear on those records?
He's a funny guy. He has a very dry wit humor, and so he's always cracking a joke about something. You know, so I think that side of him nobody sees, because he's behind the curtain. But you know, when it's just you and him in a room, you know, we talk about motorcycles, we'll talk about, you know, common things, you know. And so he's a really he's a normal person, really, and like you and me talking like this. And so I think that's the thing that a lot of people they don't know about him, that he can be as genuine and talk about anything that's going on at the same time. So I like it. We got along good, and he really likes smoking my cigarettes. So I got him this motorcycle when we were in New Orleans on Oh Mercy.
Crash, right?
That's right. Yeah. And I didn't know that at the time, but like one day he would go out. I would take him on some rides to show him some places where to go in New Orleans. Then one day he wants to go out by himself. And so I said, all right. And he doesn't have a helmet on, because he's from California and there was no helmet law in California. Right. And so he'd come back from his ride and he would say, the police are so friendly here. I said, Bob, there's a helmet law here. They're waving at you because you're not wearing a helmet. They're trying to pull you over. And he's like, oh, really? I'm like, yeah. And then on another day he goes out, and I hear him stall the bike around the corner just as he gets around in front of the house. So I walk out the gate and I walk around, and there's these two people. Like, he's sitting there, his bike's not running, he's holding the handlebars. And these people are saying, Bob, can we get your autograph? And I walk up and I said, leave the guy alone, you know? And so he just sat on the bike, like if there was nobody there, and he'd kind of like zone them out. And so I went over and, hey, what's going on? He says, just stop. I go, I looked, and he forgot to put the gas petcock on. So on the old Harleys, you got to turn the gas on because it will fire up, but it'll only go so far before it runs out of gas. So I turned that on, it fired right back up again. Off he went on his little trip. But, you know, we had people going through the garbage cans looking for cigarette butts, and, you know, some people would come to the gate and say, yeah, well, we want to take Bob fishing. I'm like, yeah, sure you do. But I would never admit that Bob was there. Like, people, we heard Bob Dylan's here. I go, Bob, who, what? What are you talking about? And so I was, you know, we'd never give it up. And then same at the Teatro, I had put these gates across the front of the Teatro to stop people from coming to the door. One day I had left it open and there was somebody at the door. I had this system in the studio where if you push the buzzer for the door, a light would flash in the studio. So I knew somebody was at the door. So then I ran to the door and this guy says, tell Bob so-and-so's here. And I said, oh, I said, there's no Bob here. And he goes, just go tell Bob that I'm here. I'm his son. And I'm like, oh shit, okay. And so I went back and said, Bob, do you have a son? You know, so I wouldn't give it up that his dad was in there. But when he said he's my son, I had to go to Bob and say, do you have a son? He goes, yeah, I told him to come by. I'm like, okay. So he came in and hung up. But yeah, but other than that, you know, it's like, and I had the, you know, Oxnard Police Department kind of watching after us and stuff like that. So I made friends with the police department and gave them some money for their children's activity fund. And they gave me free security in a way. And yeah, so I had the police on my side there. It was pretty good.
We talked before and you told me about your photo book that's coming out. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah,
while we
so have. that Yeah. So I've been taking photos for the last 30 years, and I've finally put all these photos into a book. And so what I use is like a time-lapse photography where I just put my Nikon camera on top of the desk, and it just takes pictures. Every 30 seconds, you get a photo and whatever. And to the end of the day, I just look and pick the best ones and kind of archive them. I've got amazing shots from Oh Mercy, Bob, you know, sitting at the counter, drinking coffee, writing. And then, you know, with his hoodie, he had this, went through this hoodie period where he's got the hoodie. And, you know, I'm into motorcycles. And so he saw some of the motorcycles I had in the courtyard. So I got him this police special, and we'd go out riding, and I'd show them where to ride in the levees and all that kind of stuff. So all that's in the book. And then some beautiful shots of him at the teatro, just in his, he had this chair, and he'd always sit in this chair, and he had these boots with these bells on them. He just kind of like would sit there, and we'd listen. And that was his kind of little spot in the teatro. And so I got some beautiful shots of him sitting there, because you say, hey, you got a camera? Can you take a picture of me? And I'm like, yeah, sure, no problem. So there's a whole series of those photos in there, which are kind of cool. And, you know, there's, you know, all throughout, you know, there's like the Neville brothers and Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and all these great people that I've, you know, worked with in the past. And so I've got beautiful photos of working with them. And so... You know, my whole trip is I don't make records usually in studios. I either find interesting environments and you know, bring my gear in and we set up and everybody will live there, or, you know, it will be kind of like a band camp kind of thing where a lot of these records were made, you know, in these cool places. So the book's called Recording Icons / Creative Spaces. So it comes out November 1st, and hopefully it'll be a nice coffee table book for people. You know, they'll get to see their favorite people in those records, what it was like right there in the room, you know. So,
all right, Mark, I think, you know, I think that covers it well. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. I think this was fantastic.
All right, cheers.
All right, I hope you enjoyed those stories and insights on the creation of Time Out of Mind. One very cool bonus, over at the Freak Music Tomb 25 blog, we have images from Mark Howard's engineer's notebook, of which he spoke. The resolution isn't great, but you can see how Mark kept track of the instruments and even the lines in each song, those tape numbers that he was talking about that he used with Bob to find lyrics and make changes. We have photos of the pages from Not Dark Yet and Highlands. The Highlands page is particularly interesting because it shows the length of the alternate take and some of the different words used in that version. As I said, the resolution isn't great, but it's still very interesting to see. We'll see you again soon for more of Dylan's Time Out of Mind.
Don't forget to subscribe and rate this podcast. It really helps. For bonus episodes and more, become a member at freakmusic.club/join. And you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram at FMC_Dylan. Thanks for listening.